are listening to the Issues on Appeal podcast, focusing on timely and timeless issues of appellate practice and professionalism. Here is your host, Dwayne Diker.
Thanks for joining me for episode 68, Additional Briefing Requirements in the 6th DCA. This show is again sponsored by Court Surety Bond Agency, the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds. More about CSBA later in the show. In this episode, I'm joined by appellate specialists Jamie Moses and Chris Donovan to discuss the newest administrative order in the 6th DCA, AO 24-1, titled Additional Briefing Requirements in the 6th District Court of Appeal, issued on April 1, 2024. My discussion with Jamie and Chris is coming up next. So Jamie and Chris, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's an honor.
So, you know, part of the tagline for the podcast is timely and timeless issues in appellate practice. And so this episode is definitely a timely, since we're discussing something that just transpired a few days ago on April 1st, 2024. I'm pretty sure it wasn't an April Fool's Day joke. But specifically, we're talking about the 6th DCA's newest administrative order. It's 24-1, which establishes additional briefing requirements for that court. And if you want to read it for yourself, there's a link in the show notes. You can find it prominently on the 6th DCA website. In short, it requires appellants to include, as a part of their initial brief, a statement of the basis for appellate jurisdiction and a statement of preservation with a record citation to show where in the record or appendix the issue was raised and ruled upon by the trial court. Chris, do I have the gist of that correct?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the gist of it.
So, you know, I was wondering, as an initial matter, are you guys familiar with any other DCAs that modify briefing requirements under the Florida rules? Because I can't think of any.
No, I'm not aware of any.
I can't think of any either, at least not at the state level.
Right. So I think this is kind of breaking new ground. And I guess we should start just by looking at the rule itself. You can find the rule right on the website. I'm looking at a copy now. It's not a lengthy rule, but it's kind of interesting. It's about a one-page rule, but they also include a couple pages of examples, which I don't recall ever seeing in an admin order. It's kind of like it's an admin order, but then it's got some practice pointers all wrapped up into it, which is kind of unusual.
Well, the admin orders related to extensions of time certainly provide example language. So there is precedent for that.
That is true. There's like sample language that you can adapt. Yeah. But I guess what's interesting is they've attached a couple pages of different examples, but maybe that's because this is not necessarily an easy thing to describe.
But I do have a question. I mean, the statement of jurisdiction, that's been in my brief for 30 years. I don't think that's new. I've always had a statement of jurisdiction. So I don't know what they're necessarily adding. But, well, you know what? I call it the statement of the case. For me, my statement of the case is always the courts, how they have jurisdiction. I always detail that. And then the statement of facts are the facts. But I guess now, I don't know, I guess I'll have to do it differently now.
That's interesting, because unless there's already been some debate about jurisdiction, or we're talking about an original proceeding where you usually have to identify that. There's actually a specific section that says to do that in the appellate rules. I don't usually go into the jurisdictional aspect, unless, particularly if it's a final appeal, unless somebody's raised that.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's generally my procedure too, as it relates to jurisdiction. I mean, you have to identify the rule in your notice of appeal, and unless you anticipate there's going to be some sort of issue, I don't generally spend time on it. Unless, like you said, if it's a extraordinary writ, you have to, right? The rules require you to explain what the jurisdictional basis is. So, yeah, it is an interesting change, I think. So the subpart A of the rule says that you have to include a statement of the basis for jurisdiction in this court, including the basis for claiming the judgment order appealed from is final. That's interesting. You have to explain why you think it's final. And if non-final, the basis for claiming the judgment order appealed from is otherwise appealable, including the procedural rule or statutory provision. So they're asking for a lot of detail there on jurisdiction.
Yes, but I will note one thing, though, is that this is the essentially the second version of this administrative order, because when the 6DCA started on January 1st of last year, they rolled out several administrative orders, including one that was basically the same thing. You know, we want to see how we have jurisdiction and, you know, where the issue is preserved in your brief front and center. So this is kind of a modification of, I don't remember exactly which AO that was. It was 23-something, maybe 03, 04.
I think 01.
01? Okay, even better.
In this order, they say that it supersedes Administrative Order 23-01.
There you go, yeah. But it's almost like we weren't doing it correctly, so we want to give you a little more detail so that it's very explicit what we want to see. And that's why they gave us those examples.
Yeah, because now they're actually saying that it has to be a separate section of the brief. Mm-hmm. It has to be called out in the table of contents. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's a lot of messaging, right, that this is important and we want to see it and we want to be sure that you include it, which kind of begs the question, you know, what will happen if appellants don't do this? Do we think that the clerk's office is going to screen these things at the outset and reject briefs that don't contain it? Or do we think it's going to get to the level of staff attorneys looking at it after perfection? I mean, it seems to me like maybe the clerk is going to look at this thing right off the bat and turn things around.
Well, and I've had an initial brief sent back because I mistakenly failed to include. I included the jurisdiction part because I automatically do. It's just my standard statement of the case is my jurisdictional argument. But I forgot to add a separate where was it preserved statement because the case involves something that the judge did for the very first time in the final judgment. And it got kicked back to me and I had to, by the clerk's office, and it was quick. It wasn't a delayed. I mean, I think it was the day the brief was filed and it got kicked back. And then I've been the appellee where the other side didn't do jurisdiction or where was the issue raised or preserved. And that was throughout the whole brief. I mean, you couldn't see it anywhere in the brief. And that brief got kicked back and they were told to add these to it. And it was kicked back by the clerk as well. So that's what I think is going to happen. I don't think these are jurisdictional requirements. I don't think you're going to be out of court on these. But I do think it's going to be a problem that you're going to have to fix pretty quickly.
I've seen the same thing, but I haven't seen it happen as quick as it sounds like Jamie has seen it. Because oftentimes, it's usually where I'm the appellee. I don't think I've yet to have one of mine kicked it back out. But the typically as the appellee, I have seen several briefs get kicked. Usually, though, it took 2 or 3 weeks. I had one instance where I had already done a stipulated motion for extension of time. And a week after I filed that stipulation is when the clerk kicked it back and said, you know, to the appellant, he needs to redo it to include that. And then it left me going, well, does this restart my time or does this restart the number of stipulated extensions? What happens after that? Because it isn't very clear. If the order, you know, that's true with any striking of briefs, what happens? I mean, I think most of us would all agree that it usually just means whenever they file their new brief, that's when your 30 days begins again.
Well, that's interesting. I guess I hadn't appreciated the fact that the six was already kicking back briefs for a failure to comply with this. So then it does kind of beg the question of why they felt the need to make the requirement even more specific. I guess maybe the kicking back briefs wasn't working or they just wanted more level of detail. I mean, what do you think about that?
I just comparing the two rules because I'm looking at them. I think this is purely so that the clerk doesn't have to look for it in the brief so that the clerk can go, okay, page 2, boom, 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 page 3. I mean, that's the way I look at this because they've barely changed the two rules looking at them, barely. but they give examples and it's the whole table of contents thing. So I think it is just so that the clerk can go, okay, final order, this rule, and this was raised, ruled upon, and preserved. That's what I think.
I think that's accurate. I think what Jamie said is true. It's one of the reasons why I, how do I say this in a way that doesn't get me in trouble? It's one of the reasons why I struggle with this rule or any of these rules related to sort of waving a flag related to jurisdiction and preservation, because I like to weave that into a more blended version of the case, you know, make it, you know, it's like standard of review. I don't want a separate standard of review section when I got three or four sections that I'm going to be talking about that have, might have different standards of review. I'd rather embed that standard in the beginning of my intro for a particular issue. And it's the same concept as the, for, you know, preservation, and again, less on jurisdiction because it's usually pretty clear. So that's, I struggle. Now I'm going to have to, it seems repetitive and we only have a certain number of words. So
they're cramping your creative style, Chris,
yeah,
right?
Perfect. Yeah.
What I don't like is the language along with a concise statement of the relevant facts establishing jurisdiction. I mean, I normally say mother or, you know, Party A appeals the final judgment rendered by the trial court on XYZ date under rule 9. blah, blah, blah. Am I now going to have to explain why that final judgment is final? Like, what are the concise statement of relevant facts other than its title is final judgment and it's a final order? I mean, how much more do we have to add to establish the court's jurisdiction?
Right. And because you're already doing a concise statement of facts, right, as a part right. of your statement of the facts and statement of the case, it's going to be interesting to see. And of course, nobody knows yet because this version of the rule doesn't go into effect until June 1st. So we have like 7 weeks that we can pull our hair out about how they're going to enforce it. But it is interesting. I don't love the fact that it ties our hands a little bit in the way we want to present our case. And Chris, like you said, maybe it just has to be duplicative. Maybe you say it the way you want to say it, but you also have to say it this way. As long as you're not up against word requirements, I guess that's okay. But it goes against, I generally love brevity.
Right. And to Jamie's point, and to go back to my point, at least on the jurisdictional side, I have been able to figure out a way to blend it. And I typically, it seems like they want it now higher up in the brief, but I would typically make that as a part, since the new rule last year, I made it as a part of my standard of review. This court has jurisdiction and the standard, that's my section title. And the standard of review is de novo or whatever. And then in terms of the facts, it's more procedural facts for me, unless we're talking about how something's an immediate right to property or something where we're under a non-final rule. But for me, it's more procedural facts that I include. To Jamie's point, it's like, okay, a final summary judgment was entered as to all parties and all issues on X date. A rehearing was filed on Y date. Therefore, this court, you know, that told the deadline for appeal. Therefore, this court has jurisdiction under, you know, 9.110 and Article whatever of the Constitution. That's to me the extent of the facts needed.
I hope so.
And my biggest issue is more with the preservation point. I mean, jurisdiction makes sense because you can't waive jurisdiction,
right?
And so they in you know, courts need to be conscientious of non-waivable things like jurisdiction. So I totally get that point.
Today's show is sponsored by Court Surety Bond Agency, the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedeas bonds. If you have a client needing to stay enforcement of a judgment in Florida or any other state or federal court, contact CSBA. Chances are you don't deal with appellate bonds on a daily basis, but when you do, it's important and it's urgent. CSBA has an extensive collection of educational and reference materials on their website, including articles like, "How much does an appeal bond cost?" or "Using real estate to secure appeal bonds," and even has a state-by-state guide to appeal bond requirements. But if you still have questions or just want to talk to a knowledgeable appellate bond specialist, call CSBA at 877-810-5525. Their contact information is always in the show notes, but I suggest you take an opportunity right now to to add their contact information to your own contact list so you're ready the next time your client needs a court bond. CSBA is a national agency that assists with court bonds all over the United States, but has extensive experience in Florida. In addition to being a longtime sponsor of this podcast, CSBA is a premier sponsor of the Florida Bar's Appellate Practice Section. The next time your client needs a supersedeas bond, please give Court Surety Bond Agency a call. These folks are experts in this area. They'll guide you and your client through the process, giving you one less thing to worry about. Well, so we've been focused on jurisdiction, but let's talk about the preservation issue. Obviously, it would be good practice for an appellant to identify the preservation if there was any question about it. And I think most of us probably do. But, here, calling out the appellant and sort of forcing them to put their cards on the table as to exactly where the preservation occurs, what do you think about that? Which way does that cut? And obviously it benefits the court because the court staff is going to look for that at some point. But how does it benefit the appellant? How does it benefit the appellee? Where do you come down on that, Chris?
I say this more as a thought experiment and I could be convinced otherwise. So please, if there's 60 CA judges listening, please don't get mad at me. But I guess I come down on this. Why is it that we need to identify where it's been preserved? Because to me, preservation is no different than standing. It's no different than statute of limitations. It's waivable. Why isn't it waivable? Why should I help the appellee out by waving a flag that I didn't preserve, or my trial attorney didn't preserve this very well? Plus, honestly, preservation is in the eye of the beholder at times. What I think could be sufficiently preserved, even though it may not have gone into the same level of detail that an appellate attorney goes into, may not be considered preserved by the opposing counsel. But if he or she doesn't say anything, then to me it's waived. Now, I realize there are some cases out there. There's one in particular I was trying to actually, while you were doing the intro, Dwayne, to find it. But there's one in particular out there out of the second where the appellee conceded error and the second DCA said, no, sorry, you know, this isn't preserved. We're still going to affirm. And why? Why is suddenly preservation elevated to the same level as jurisdiction and can't be waived?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Right. I see from the court's perspective, right, is that they want a better brief and they want to put the appellants on the spot because it's their burden to identify it. Yeah, as appellees, we don't always want that, right? Sometimes we want to sit back a little bit and let the appellant paint themselves into a corner by not identifying these issues. It's interesting. It's hard to argue against compliance with the rules and the need for a better brief. But as somebody who mostly represents an appellee, I don't love it.
Dwayne, if they can't show where they've preserved something, that's pretty helpful to you, I think.
It is. That's what I'm saying. It does cut both ways, right? It just depends on how strong the appellant's case is on error. Yeah, I don't know. I can see the arguments both ways, and I can see, Chris's point that this is sort of making preservation unwaivable, which is a substantive change in the law.
My concern is simply, it's already hard enough to be an appellant. It's already hard enough. And now here's just one more wrinkle, so to speak. And half of the time, I think we all know, it's sometimes hard to get a definitive ruling. Or you get a ruling, but then it's changed. And are you supposed to renew it? And the issue of whether you're preserving that issue sort of gets muddied. And I just feel like this is now just one more hurdle to getting relief at the appellate level. And, you know, our odds are already stacked against us as an appellant, if we are one. And I just don't want it to get to a point where you can honestly say to a client, it's virtually virtually impossible to get appellate relief. I mean, the three of us would lose our jobs. But you know what I mean? I don't want it to be that way. And I feel like this is now just one more obstacle in the way.
I agree.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't want trial lawyers to not do anything down below. I don't want them to do their job. However, if the other side lets something go, like Chris said, then that to me is fair game. Absolutely. But I guess not.
And just to kind of go along with that for a moment, I do think that there is, you know, sometimes it happens where you're the appellant and you're a sophisticated appellate attorney, and you make these, you know, very creative arguments that you sort of tangentially tie to something that would happen below. And the other side maybe is not represented by a sophisticated attorney with respects to appeals, and who doesn't naturally think in terms of preservation, and tipsy coachman, and stuff like that. I think that does put clients who want to pay for a sophisticated appellate attorney at a disadvantage then for somebody who isn't willing to spend the money for that.
Correct.
Well, as somebody who hopefully is one of those sophisticated appellate attorneys, I like that idea. But playing devil's advocate, you can see the counter argument there, which is, well, you shouldn't have to hire an appellate lawyer, an appellate specialist, in order for the law to work in the way it's supposed to work. So, you know, I mean, I do see that argument that if the court is forcing the appellant to spell out the preservation, you know, maybe we'll see more cases. Maybe we'll see more cases dismissed for lack of preservation, but maybe that's okay. I don't know.
I don't disagree with you, Dwayne, but this isn't a matter of law, because preservation is not a matter of law. It's a matter of, you know, it's a court rule. It's a common law rule of convenience, isn't it? Largely.
Now you're getting deep on me, Chris. Uh-huh. It's certainly a very well established and time honored rule, right? Whether it's procedural or substantive. I mean, I think it feels substantive to me, and that the whole point of the appellate process is that the trial court shouldn't be held accountable for errors that, you know, that weren't brought to the court's attention below, and that they didn't have an opportunity to rule on. It kind of goes to the heart of the appellate process, but, you know, we all know that it's not nearly as black and white as that. And in the heat of trial, things get very dicey and there's a whole lot of gray. And yeah, you don't necessarily want to see that become a weapon against appellants so that they can't get relief in a situation where they should.
You know, I sort of fear I had a case once where I know, you know, one of the issues wasn't preserved well, but the second issue was. And I just think of like the nightmare of an appeal getting dismissed because there's a misunderstanding as to one of the issues being preserved. You know what I mean? And what the hoops you're going to have to jump through to get an appeal reinstated on the issue that was, you know, undeniably preserved and the other one was iffy. You know what I mean? It will be interesting to see this played out. And just what's going to happen, just how it's going to happen. Because think of us, and if we're the appellant, and all of a sudden our appeal's kicked out on a preservation issue, just how scary that's going to be.
It puts a huge amount of pressure on trial lawyers, right?
Right, right.
Now we have to tell our trial lawyers, we're getting our trial, hey, you know, we're going to be called on the carpet as to exactly the moment at which you preserved any error that we want to assert. So make sure you're on it, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, I actually just had that conversation with a trial attorney who called me 2 days ago when this order came out. And I was like, well, listen, you should be aware of this. These sound like great arguments, but are you sure you raised him below?
Yeah.
Particularly, there was one in particular that I was like, well, that sounds like a really interesting point, but you wouldn't have thought of that until rehearing. Are you sure you raised that?
Yeah.
Yeah, it creates an interesting tension between, you know, you want appellants to be able to get into appellate courts on valid issues, but you also don't want the court clogged up with cases that shouldn't be there because they weren't preserved and the trial judge really didn't get an opportunity to rule. I mean, it's an interesting tension. It really is, Jamie, kind of back to what you were saying a lot about how open is the door to the appellate court. And that maybe closes it just a little bit.
And I mean, I understand that our new batches of judges really do believe that the courts should not be, because they often get asked, why are so many PCAs being issued? And a lot of judges will say, look, if I'm not going to expand the law of the state, and if there's nothing I would write that would add to anything, we're just going to PCA, because there's no need to do more. I get that. I'm trying to appreciate it. Of course, it's hard when you explain to your clients, we won, but I can't tell you why. And here's a one-page document that I billed you $50,000 to $75,000 to get, right? That's super hard, super hard. I think this goes with that in the sense that the appellate courts don't want to be asked to consider things that weren't properly presented to the trial court and thus shouldn't be properly presented to, or shouldn't be presented to, the appellate court because they're error correcting courts. The problem I have is the same as Chris's. If the other side doesn't do what they need to do to raise this issue, why is it now that the clerk of the court is basically going to be deciding that issue without it being raised by an appellee? That sort is what I'm struggling with.
You know, I'm also struggling with some aspect, even as an appellee, particularly where the court has placed this statement of preservation before the argument section, but not necessarily tied to each individual points. You know, as the appellee, do I need to now have this sort of pre-argument before I get into the argument? Or I mean, I'm actually not entirely sure if the 6th DCA is doing the same thing that the 2nd DCA does, with where they compile, their staff attorneys compile summations, or where they break up the briefs by issue to issue, or compilations, or if they're reading them, sort of in the original native format. I'm not sure the answer to that question. Maybe you all know, but it does question, if I don't want to have this extensive argument that I disagree with preservation before we even get into the argument, can I rearrange the brief, if you will, to address preservation embedded in the individual section that it relates to? I don't know. Do you all have any thoughts?
No, I mean, I think that they seem to be inviting you to do it separately by having a separate section. And they always tell us, they'd like the answer briefs to mirror the initial briefs and such. But you could do it either way. I mean, I think that's a judgment call and that's an advocacy call. I think you can, if you think it's more effective to build it in, I think you certainly have that option.
You know what looks to be noticeably, I don't know about for you guys, but what looks to be noticeably absent from the attached table of contents is a standard of review section, which I thought we had to now specifically set out in a separate, in the argument section. You had to open up your argument with the standard of review, correct?
Yes, although I guess they never said it had to be in the table of contents, but it would make sense for it to be there, right?
Yeah,
I generally do tend to break it out now just because they've sort of signaled that that's an important thing that they're looking for.
Correct.
Well, but that does kind of come to another point, and that is I think that we all agree, and it makes total sense, that they want the clerk's office to be a gatekeeper, and this does make it easier for them to quickly review this and move on to the next case, make sort of check the boxes. But I do wonder how effective it's ultimately going to be, because you'll have some attorneys that will be very perfunctory in what they say, and in I can almost imagine a staff attorney or the judge going, well, he says it's there, but I don't, where?
Yeah, that raises the question of what will that initial review be? Will it just be that there is a section and it has a sentence in it and it has a notation in the table of contents? Or is there going to be, you know, more of a substantive review that of that? I can't imagine there will be much of a substantive review until the case is perfected and it's sent back to a suite, right? I can't imagine that the clerk is going to make value judgments about your preservation unless it's just so clearly, you know, so clearly bad. Then maybe they send it to a judge and say, hey, should we kick this back? But yeah, no, it's going to be very interesting to see how it goes.
Yeah, it is.
As an aside, you know, there's also an interesting question, and I don't think we can resolve it here today, and maybe we shouldn't. But, you know, I've heard people asking the question, hey, is this really something that the Florida appellate courts can modify by administrative order? And, you know, I think we don't question, it's interesting, we don't question this as much in the federal courts. You know, the local rules for federal courts, sometimes I just did an appeal in the federal circuit, and the local rules modified the federal rules of appellate procedure to an extent that it was unrecognizable. You know, and so the federal courts do this all the time, but this is unusual for the state courts to do something this sort of substantive by administrative order. It's an interesting question.
It very much is an interesting question.
Yes.
And you know, I know that you all have the privilege of this, but I sent down around an email last night that kind of, you know, for a thought experiment, so to say, looked at, you know, where's the authority in the Constitution or the rule authority to issue these administrative orders, and how far can the administrative orders go? And I was a little, you know, surprised at the distinctions that are drawn there at the constitutional level. It's only the Supreme Court that obviously can issue rules under Article 5, Section 2. But the Supreme Court has issued the Florida Rules of General Practice and Judicial Administration, which sort of delegates some level of rulemaking and administrative order making authority. And I say in rulemaking or administrative order because those rules do draw a distinction between those two things. They draw a distinction between sort of court rules, which is what the Supreme Court issues, and you know that we have like Florida Rules of Appellate Procedure, and then they draw a distinction between local rules, which coincidentally are only trial courts or circuit courts and county courts can issue local rules under 2.140, I believe it is, and then the appellate courts, the district courts, they actually, at least I can't identify a specific rule that allows them to issue local rules. All they can issue is administrative orders. And the process for an administrative order versus a local rule is different because a local rule still requires public comment and approval by the Florida Supreme Court. Again, that's only that circuits and trial courts or circuits and county courts can do that. Whereas administrative orders do not require public comment and they don't have to be approved by the Supreme Court. They just can't be inconsistent with a Supreme Court rule. But they narrowly define administrative order as a, quote, directive necessary to administer properly the court affairs, but not inconsistent with the Constitution. So is this, you know, is this type of order that changes substantively in some respects, at least we've argued in terms of requiring identification of preservation, but it certainly changes Rule 9.210 and the content of initial briefs. Is this administrative order permissible? Is that considered a directive necessary to administer properly the court affairs? Versus, I should read the definition of a local rule, which seems to be more fitting for what this administrative order is doing, and that is a rule of practice or procedure for circuit and county application. because, and it's, it goes on to say that it exists because it supplies an omission in or facilitates application of a rule of statewide application. So it's kind of, it's when the circuit courts and county courts are sort of filling in, you know, gap fillers that don't exist in the civil rules of procedure or family rules of procedure or small claims court rules of procedures. But from what I can tell, at least my basic quick research last night while eating dinner, the administrative orders are usually more administered, more narrow to court administration, not so much substantive changes of how briefs are presented or the identification of preservation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think that the court's position would likely be, oh, that's all this is. This is just taking existing requirements and saying where you should put it in your brief and your table of contents requirements. And, you know, we've already talked about this, that is one way of looking at it. But we would say maybe it's more than that. So it is an interesting question, I guess. You know, I don't know who or how somebody would challenge that rule, or whether it would be fruitful to do so. But it is, at least, you know, when appellate lawyers get together and have a couple of cocktails after a CLE, it's an interesting topic of discussion. Do they have that authority or not?
Yeah. Speaking of which, Duane, where is my cocktail? I thought one was going to be delivered here on a Friday while we do this podcast.
Oversight on my part.
I suspect that there's going to be, are either one of you on the appellate court rules committee again? I mean, I know you guys have already served. I wonder if there's going to be some sort of suggestion that the briefing rule is revised to add these things. I mean, just given the new makeups of our courts, and just the stance that they have been taken on preservation and issues like that, I wonder if that's going to be the next thing, is just change it in the rules.
That would seem like the proper way to approach it. If enough people in the Florida Supreme Court agree that this is something that should be done, a rule amendment would seem to be a proper way to do it, for sure.
And it would allow for public comment, which an administrative order does not allow for public comment. That might offer insights such as, why is preservation not waivable, and you know, maybe counsel against putting something so explicit in the brief.
And I suppose the issue could be forced by a change to the rules in some fashion, because then the administrative order can't be inconsistent with the Florida Rules of Appellate Procedure. So that could set up a, you know, determination of how this really is properly done.
The real issue will be is if it was presented to the ACRC and then rejected, and then the six still kept it. That would be very interesting. But, you know, we'll live for another day for that. I hope to be retired by the time this gets resolved.
Me too.
Yeah.
I think I have a ways yet, so.
Oh, well.
Well, thank you, guys. I don't know that we've solved the world's problems or the state's problems or any particular DCA's problems, but I know this is something that appellate practitioners are talking about, and so I thought it would be a good time for us to talk about it, and maybe in a couple months when we have some real-world experience and we see how this goes into play, we can talk about it again. I'd love to talk to you guys about it, because you do a lot more work in the sixth than I do, so... But thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it. Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Thanks, Jamie.
Bye, guys.
My thanks to Jamie and Chris for joining me on short notice for this episode. Remember, podcasts are never legal advice. Nothing that I say or my guests say should ever be interpreted as legal advice for any particular situation. But if you're a lawyer who needs the help of an appellate lawyer, I'm happy to try and help. And please consider using our sponsor, Court Surety Bond Agency, for your client's appellate bond needs. When you need a bond, you often need it quickly. CSBA's contact information is in the show notes. Please take a moment now, add it to your contacts, so that you're ready when your client needs a supersedious bond. I know the podcast episodes have been slow coming, and I appreciate your patience. I've heard so many folks talking about this new administrative order that I thought we need to talk about this now, and we may follow up in the future just to kind of see how it's going. There'll be at least one more episode on section history soon, and more appellate content. I hope that you will continue to download and listen.
Thank you for considering this week's Issues on Appeal.